You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The United States has been engaged on and off in some form of conflict with Iraq for almost two decades now, with two major bookends, the 1991 Gulf War and the current situation in Iraq, which was launched in 2003. Although the conflicts have certain similarities, they both involve Saddam Hussein, Dick Cheney, and members of the Bush family, they represent two distinct and competing schools in U.S. foreign policy, according to Council of Foreign Relations President Richard Haass. And he is in a position to know because Mr. Haass served in both Bush administrations when each President Bush weighed going to war with Iraq. His latest book, War of Necessity, War of Choice, is published by Simon & Schuster. I'm very pleased that it brings him back to our show today. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
The title of the book, War of Necessity, War of Choice, I'm guessing I know which one is which in your estimation. But how would you define what constitutes a war of necessity and a war of choice?
A war of necessity, I would argue, is a war where vital interests are at stake. And secondly, there are simply no other viable policy alternatives other than the use of force, either because they don't exist or because they've been tried and found wanting. A war of choice, by contrast, tends to be lesser interests. And more important, there are other policies that could be embraced, from doing nothing to diplomacy to what have you.
But the second war in Iraq was presented as a war of necessity, wasn't it? There were the weapons of mass destruction. There was the yellow cake, which was going to lead to the mushroom cloud.
It was, but it didn't hold, it didn't make a case then. And it didn't in retrospect, sorry, for some reason I am losing my voice here. In retrospect, it wasn't a necessity. Saddam Hussein had not done anything new with weapons of mass destruction. He was not about to invade Kuwait or Saudi Arabia or anything else. As we now know, he was not hiding weapons of mass destruction. He was hiding the fact he did not have weapons of mass destruction.
And there are people who would argue that President Bush was presented with all that information and ignored it. But I don't know what your feeling is. It's my sense that you supported the war initially because you believed those things and then you changed your mind.
No, actually, I was against the war from the get-go. I described myself as having been 60-40 against the war. It was divided, if you will, or muted, because I did think Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, in particular chemical and biological weapons, as, by the way, did every single analyst I met at the intelligence community.
And then I met with I talked to Hans Blix on the show, and he said, I've been there, it's not there. And you either believe Hans Blix, we ridiculed Hans Blix, but he happened to have been right. Is it standard policy to present a potential conflict as necessary in order to help drum up public support and quell dissent?
There's a case for arguing necessity, but take the Clinton administration in Bosnia and Kosovo. They made the argument that this was the right thing to do. It was an important thing to do. I don't think they ever said if the United States doesn't do this, the republic will not stand. That was a war of choice, and it makes the larger point that sometimes war of choices – or wars of choice, rather, are justifiable. It simply depends on the likelihood that using military force will achieve more than it will cost, and that it's likely to be the best available option.
And you'd say that World War II was a war of necessity. I don't think anybody would disagree. But you also say the Korean War, and considering the latest news from Pyongyang, did the Korean War resolve anything?
Oh, for sure. When North Korea came across the 38th parallel in June of 1950, if the United States and the world had not resisted, it wouldn't have simply been that the Korean Peninsula would have been all communist. It would have fundamentally affected the trajectory of Japan. It would have emboldened the Soviet Union. It would have emboldened communist China. So yes, it changed history what the United States did. Though I also say Korea is fascinating because it began as a war of necessity. And then after MacArthur and Truman went north of the 38th parallel to liberate the whole country, it transformed into a war of choice and an extraordinarily expensive war of choice.
But, you know, the same kinds of arguments we used about Vietnam, the domino theory, and the domino theory didn't really pan out, did it?
No, I thought Vietnam was a classic war of choice. The United States did not have to do what it did. Even then, there were other options. Again, one could argue whether the interests at stake in Vietnam were vital. I would say they were less than vital. But more important, there were other options. Even those who advocated going to war did not deny that there were other options. They simply thought that going to war would be a better option.
You're right that wars of choice, I'm quoting, increase pressure on governments to show that the overall or net results will be positive. Can you think of any war of choice that has ever met that threshold?
Oh, for sure. Again, I already mentioned the Balkan Wars, both Bosnia and Kosovo.
By the way, Bill Clinton was highly criticized for going into by many people in the Republican Party.
On the grounds that it wasn't essential. So that is one. We were talking before the show about things like Rwanda. I would say those were wars of choice that weren't fought. And people have criticized those for what we did not do. The United States and the world, if you will, paid an enormous price for not intervening.
Now, both the Iraq War and the Gulf War were wars of choice, but they seem to have been conducted differently, which
just
I
to
found...
be clear, actually, just to be clear, the first one I would describe was a war of necessity.
Oh, you do feel it?
Yes,
was.
Sir. Hence the title.
And why?
Well, I believe that when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait in the summer of 1990, it became a war of necessity for two reasons. One, Iraq owns 10% of the world's oil. With Kuwait, gave it 20%. If Saddam Hussein had been allowed to get away with keeping Kuwait, he not only would have owned a fifth of the world's oil, but Saudi Arabia would not have been independent except in name. Secondly, this was the beginning. People forget. This was 1990. This was less than a year after the Berlin Wall came down. How the United States and the world reacted to this invasion and occupation, this was going to determine the entire character of this new period of history. So I thought the strategic control of oil and setting the personality for a new era of history, all of this translated into a war of necessity, particularly once it became clear that neither sanctions nor diplomacy would do the trick.
It's interesting that in that war of necessity, we sent an awful lot of troops, but with limited goals.
Exactly.
In the war of choice, we sent fewer troops. Donald Rumsfeld felt we could win with far fewer troops than were sent for Desert Storm. And we had confused goals.
You're exactly right. It's one of the stunning number of contrasts about these two conflicts, which on the surface are similar. Both involve Bush, both involve Iraq and so forth, and Saddam Hussein. Yet the more you drill down, the more it's impossible not to be struck by the differences, and you've just put your finger on a big one.
Now, many people after the weapons of mass destruction didn't turn up started arguing other things. Saddam Hussein was a terrible dictator. We were going to bring democracy to the Middle East. We had to go in there because it would be chaos otherwise. I can't remember all the different arguments, all of which didn't seem to really be worked out by what actually happened.
Very much. But I actually think turning Iraq into a democracy and by establishing that model of precedent, transforming the region, I actually believe that was the real reason for the war. I never thought that the weapons of mass destruction argument was really what motivated the 43rd president. He wanted to do something big after 9/11. He wanted to show that the United States could be an agent of history and not simply a victim of history. He wanted to do something big and bold, truly historic in the region. I actually think that's what led to the war.
My guest is Richard N. Haass, who's written a book called War of Necessity, War of Choice, A Memoir of Two Iraq Wars, published by Simon & Schuster. Well, you know, there's been an awful lot of pop psychology readings into the minds of and the relationship between both Presidents Bush, especially when it comes to their decisions about how to deal with Iraq. Do you think that George W. Bush's thinking on Iraq was strongly influenced by how his father had conducted the Gulf War?
If it was, it didn't show in the sense that his father, as you pointed out before, used enormous numbers of troops for limited goals, put together an extraordinarily an unprecedented international coalition. All of those things were very different from his son. Few troops, ambitious goals, largely a unilateral undertaking. There are those who have suggested that somehow the second President Bush's purpose was to somehow finish what his father began, but I don't think so.
And also avenge his father. There were the stories of a possible assassination plot.
Well, that was, I mean, it was true that the assassination was attempted, but again, I don't buy that. I do think, though, he wanted to be seen as a more consequential president than his father. I believe one of his readings of his father, or the fact that his father did not get reelected, and this I can't prove, I never had this conversation with him, was that though he thought his father was too limited a president, wasn't sufficiently ambitious. And the irony is that the younger President Bush, by any measure, will be seen as a consequential president. The problem is I would predict that history is going to put a big negative in front of that consequential.
And you think that the first President Bush will be treated more kindly by history?
I do believe so. I believe that that's already in a process of happening. If you look at how he handled the end of the Cold War, bringing it to an end peacefully, a united Germany within NATO, the way he handled the Gulf War we've been talking about, the fact that he brought together the Madrid Peace Conference, where Israelis and Arabs face-to-face for negotiations the first time, even his most controversial decision to raise taxes, will be seen as a responsible act of political stewardship.
A recent book suggests that he was much better at putting together a cabinet than many presidents.
For sure. It was an extraordinarily talented cabinet. And I think you'll see, actually, in a couple of years when John Meacham's writing a biography of the 41st president, and my hunch is you will, in several years when John's book is completed and published, you will actually see a large wave. I'd even go so far as to say Barack Obama's presidency, in certain ways, particularly in foreign policy, is reminiscent of the 41st president. We're seeing a certain emphasis on diplomacy, multilateralism, pragmatism, realism, a lack of talk about democracy and transformation. All of this looks in many ways akin to the spirit and substance of the 41st president.
If the weapons of mass destruction weren't a motivating factor for George W. Bush's desire to go into Iraq, why did he emphasize them so strongly?
I believe that, first of all, everybody thought they were there. There was no misleading on the question of chemical and biological, and that was seen as the principal argument to win over the international community and much of the
and
domestic
audience. It didn't win. It was interesting if you compare the way the first President Bush went after winning the international community and the second one. The first one was very successful. The second one wound up with this group of nations that included Eritrea and Poland and not the major powers of the world.
Though to be fair, W did have Britain, but that was the most significant partner. But your larger point is right. This was a largely unilateral undertaking. He could not get, as you recall, the second UN Security Council resolution that he sought that would have provided explicit backing for the war. All of this stands in stark contrast to the repeated success in the Security Council the first time around, and in a coalition, if you recall, that included countries not just like Russia, but also countries like Syria and Egypt, that you had large Arab participation in the coalition the first time around.
My guest is Richard N. Haass, President of the Council on Foreign Relations. He has been Director of Policy Planning for the Department of State, where he was Principal Advisor to Secretary of State Colin Powell from 2001 to 2003, also a Special Assistant to President George H.W. Bush, and a senior director on the staff of the National Security Council from 1989 to 1993. His book, War of Necessity, War of Choice, A Memoir of Two Iraq Wars, is published by Simon & Schuster. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Later in this hour, we'll take a look at the life and work of the great Colombian novelist Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and then Eduardo Galeano describes his latest work, Mirrors, a Retelling of the World's History. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're back with Richard N. Haass, who is the President of the Council on Foreign Relations and who served in both Bush administrations. He's written a book called War of Necessity, War of Choice, A Memoir of Two Iraq Wars, published by Simon & Schuster. How much input did you actually have in the deliberations over whether we would go to either of these wars?
In the first war, when I was working at the White House, I would say I had considerable input. In the second war, when I was working at the State Department, I had negligible input. But partially that was also because the second war was not preceded by any systematic review of policy. There never was a formal meeting in which the pros and cons of going to war were debated. I found out about it in one of my regular meetings with Condoleezza Rice. It was July of 2002, 9 months before we actually went to war, and I raised with her the question of why are we building towards this possibility, and she literally cut me off. She said, save your breath. the president's already made up his mind. And again, this was 9 months before we launched the war, and this was in the absence of any formal decision-making.
And you were working for Colin Powell.
Exactly.
Who seems to have been out of the loop, even though he was Secretary of State.
Well, when I went back right after this meeting with Condoleezza Rice and reported to Colin Powell what had happened, he thought I was exaggerating. And several days later, he got back to me and said, you were right. And by that time, a month later, he and the president had dinner in the residence of the White House. This is now early August 2002. The question on the table was not whether to go to war. The question on the table was how to go to war. And Powell urged that, again, the United States do it with congressional support, with international support through the UN. But we had moved very far. And again, what's stunning to me, and historians will scratch their heads over this, here it was, what turned out to be the defining decision of a presidency, one of the major acts in American foreign policy. And the fact that it was taken without a systematic scrubbing of the options is quite stunning.
And the president went before the UN and said he didn't want to go to war. He would do everything possible to not have a war. But you're suggesting that he was really just saying the thing that you should say before the UN?
I believe people wanted to go to war, that after 9/11 there was this desire to do something big. And the way I put it is Afghanistan, if you recall, we booted the Taliban out of power.
And then we abandoned it before we caught Osama bin Laden or the Mullah Omar or any of the other people who we really should have blamed for 9/11.
It's interesting. There was virtually no appetite for doing anything ambitious in Afghanistan, and there was extraordinary appetite for doing something ambitious in Iraq.
And did you ever get a sense of why that was?
Well, I was put in charge of Afghanistan after 9/11 by the president, and I tried to sell at meetings with the president and the vice president and everybody else the grounds for doing something fairly ambitious, and they basically thought it was pretty hopeless. There was a sense that given the political history and culture of Afghanistan, we could never accomplish anything big. And I think subconsciously, there was a sense that even if you succeeded in Afghanistan, which again they thought you couldn't, it wouldn't lead to anything big. What so excited them about Iraq is they had been led to believe that, one, you could succeed there, and two, that would be the stepping stone towards transforming this part of the world, the Middle East, that has essentially resisted modern history. So this caught people's imaginations.
Now, a caller wants to know whether the reason we went to war there really was to gain control of the second largest pool of oil in the world.
Neither war was fought to gain, quote-unquote, control of oil. Neither was fought for a commercial interest to help ExxonMobil or Chevron or anybody else. Both wars, though, were fought against the backdrop that oil is this strategic commodity that fuels literally and figuratively the world economies. But the interest in oil is strategic. It is not in any way commercial. In no way was this what you might call an imperialist campaign. Not at all.
Now, it's generally thought, probably true, that one of the reasons we didn't go after Saddam Hussein was that cooler heads prevailed, people like Colin Powell, as opposed to General Schwarzkopf. But Dick Cheney was one of the people who thought it was a bad idea to topple Saddam Hussein.
I remember the meeting in the Oval Office. This is now the end of February 1991, when we were routing the Iraqi army. And Secretary Cheney was there, Defense Secretary Cheney. Colin Powell was then the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Brent Scowcroft and others. Nobody advocated to march on Baghdad. There was no enthusiasm for it. People understood the value, if you will, of a limited effort.
So why do you think Dick Cheney changed so much from one administration to the other?
Well, in the first Bush administration, he was the odd man out.
He was the Secretary of Defense.
Exactly. He was Mr. Bush's second choice to be Secretary of Defense. It was originally going to be John Tower. He was eliminated. Dick Cheney became Secretary of Defense. But everybody else at a senior level, Colin Powell, Brent Scowcroft, Jim Baker, the president himself, were what you might call card-carrying moderates. Dick Cheney, I think, in that crowd was somewhere the odd man out. In the second Bush presidency, it was just the opposite. It was Colin Powell who was the odd man out. Instead, you had Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, Condoleezza Rice, and the president himself, all of whom were more hawkish or unilateralist, whatever you want to call it.
But the Republicans had often run on the idea that they thought regime change should not be a goal of U.S. government. And here we have these people talking very strongly about regime change.
But what you have here, and what's so interesting about these two Iraq wars, fought by these two guys named Bush, is that it represents exactly that debate.
Well, Jean Kirkpatrick, she was a major opponent of thinking about regime change.
But in
some
ways,
ridiculed it.
She was what you might call a paleo-conservative. She had the same view about the world that she had about domestic society, is that you couldn't transform either. So what's ironic is Republicans had an inconsistency, whereas domestically they were quite narrow in what they thought could be accomplished. Suddenly, internationally, this new generation of Republicans thought you could transform other societies. And this is the basic fault line now of the American foreign policy debate, whether U.S. foreign policy should limit itself to dealing with the foreign policy of others or whether we should try to determine the internal nature of others.
Some people say that this is because the neocons gained a lot of power within at least the Bush administration.
For sure. All parties are made up of various constituencies or ideologies. You see the battle being fought now in the Republican Party. Well, the foreign policy battle that was fought really going back, I think, to the Nixon-Ford years, and then with Reagan and others, the neocons essentially gained the ascendancy.
Do you think that battle, as exemplified by Colin Powell and Dick Cheney going after each other, is that comes out of the sort of thing that was happening during the Bush administration in the lead up to the war?
That battle preceded these two gentlemen, and again, it was fought very hard during the – another way of putting it, it's captured by the two Bush administrations. What will be interesting is going forward, to what extent will people conclude that those who argued for the second Iraq war were wrong? My hunch is a lot of people will say – no, that's not the right lesson of history, that they will say it was a good idea, but it was simply badly implemented by Don Rumsfeld and others. One of the things I've learned in my life is that every war is fought three times. Whether you go to war, then you fight the war, then you fight over the lessons. And my hunch is this will be no exception.
And we're still doing it about Vietnam. We're still fighting over the lessons of Vietnam.
And historians are still fighting about, say, World War I. So not a lot goes away. George Shultz once said, nothing ever ends in this town, speaking about Washington. I think he's got a point.
But you say that during the Gulf War, you spent a good amount of time thinking through post-war security arrangements for the region. What sorts of challenges did you see the region facing when that war was finished?
Well, after the first war, or preparing for after the first war, I thought that Saddam Hussein would likely be out of power. I thought his own people would get rid of him. But if he stayed, I knew that there would be a long-term need to contain Saddam Hussein. So one thing was thinking about containment. Another was how to promote an Israeli-Arab peace process, which led to Madrid. I thought we needed to do things to reduce our dependence on the region's energy. And I also believe we needed to find ways to counter Iran, because revolutionary Iran was still, I thought, the principal threat to the region, which, by the way, was one of the reasons in the first Gulf War that we did not decimate Saddam Hussein's Iraq. We wanted Iraq to remain strong enough to at least balance Iran.
My guest is Richard N. Haass. His book, War of Necessity, War of Choice, A Memoir of Two Iraq Wars, is published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. Well, going back to that, when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, isn't there good reason to believe that he thought that the United States might look the other way? After all, we had been we'd looked the other way when he invaded Iran. Mm-hmm. We had supported him. We had been a supporter of Saddam Hussein on and off for quite a while by that time.
It's possible, though, he had received certain warnings that the United States did have vital interests in that part of the world. My hunch is, though, he thought that we would probably let him get away with it. We had left Lebanon, if you recall, several years before. Even more so, he had contempt for his fellow Arabs. In my view, he thought that his fellow Arabs would never have the guts, to put it bluntly, to stand up to him. And he thought that one way or another, the United States would probably learn to live with this, that we would essentially say, okay, you could do that, but no more. That's my reading of the guy.
So when you came up with your ideas of what would happen in Iraq after the war, were you listened to?
Which war are we talking about? I'm sorry.
The Gulf War.
For the first time around, yes. The second time around, just the opposite.
Because we have done a number of shows here on all of the evaluations that were done and all the warnings that were done by emigres and others, and they pretty much predicted what came to pass. And it seems that despite all of these meetings and the papers written, everything was totally ignored.
The second time around, everything was totally ignored. Indeed, I have as the appendix to the book a memo that I wrote to Secretary of State, who shared it then with the President, the Vice President, the Secretary of Defense, and others, about the aftermath. This memo was done in the fall of 2002 and said, if you're going to go to war, here's all the things you should think of. Here's all the lessons from every other time in its history the United States has had to deal with a defeated country. And things like don't demobilize an army. Make sure you have enough troops to keep order. Don't ban from politics everyone who was in the ruling party, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what's so interesting is it bore absolutely no relationship to anything that was done.
And why do you think they ignored it all? Is it hubris?
Hubris. There was a terrible bureaucratic decision to put the Pentagon in charge of post-war planning and responsibility. It's a little bit of the parallel I would think of. It's like playing tennis with someone and having them call the lines on both sides of the court. A big mistake. Also, though, a lot of people argued for this war on the basis that it would accomplish great things at a very modest cost.
Paul Wolfowitz said that they'd be strewing rose petals before the American troops.
And people lost their jobs, you recall, for saying we needed lots of troops, so it would cost hundreds of billions of dollars.
We'll just use the oil and we would pay for the war.
And all of this turned out to be nonsense. But they assumed away all the problems in order to make the case for the war. Again, imagine somebody walked into the Oval Office and you were president, and someone said, Mr. President, I can accomplish great things at a modest cost. You would say, pretty good deal. Let's do it. And that's essentially what these people did. They promised that the United States could do this easily with very few troops. We could leave a couple of weeks or months later, and Iraq would be this functioning model of democracy, which would then change the entire region. Sounds great. The only problem was none of that whatsoever was grounded in reality.
You say that Colin Powell taught you the valuable lesson in the Cold War that initial reports in any crisis are almost always incomplete, incorrect, or both, and that it is usually best not to react quickly to what comes in and is not clearly confirmed. But then when he was Secretary of State, Colin Powell presented information to the UN on Iraq's supposed weapons of mass destruction that was incorrect and, in some cases, obtained through questionable techniques. He didn't even listen to his own advice.
Well, he did listen to his own advice. What's so interesting about that, and it's both frustrating and ironic, is the draft he began with was provided by the Vice President's office. He threw it out. He said, this is loaded. It's based upon all these factually suspect things. Let's start over. He calls up George Tenet, the director of Central Intelligence, and said, let's build a case that has real intellectual integrity that will withstand scrutiny. So for 96 hours, the senior people at the CIA, my staff and Powell's immediate staff, put together a brief. We scrubbed it. We vetted it. And at the end of 4 days, when Powell went before the United Nations and the world, I've got to tell you, we were feeling pretty good with ourselves. Sometimes in government, a good day is not simply when you accomplish something, it's when you prevent something. We thought we had prevented the Secretary of State going forward with a document that had no integrity. We thought we had gotten rid of everything that was suspect. So you can imagine the frustration when months later we learned that what we thought had been so intellectually honest turned out in part to be wrong.
And those pictures that he presented, they weren't convincing to too many people.
Well, I thought a lot of them were convincing, and what it teaches you also is
those
the lesson.
Those mobile weapons labs?
But they were refrigerated trucks, what have you. And what it teaches you is that if you have a set of assumptions, it almost becomes a lens. And everything you see, you interpret consistent with your assumption. And it's dangerous for anyone in the intelligence business not to question his or her assumptions.
Well, you said before that we continually talk about the lessons you take away from a war. But if you were to talk about that, what would be the lessons that we would take away from both the Gulf War and the Iraq War?
One is to think hard about assumptions. So many times the intelligence community or policymakers were just flat out wrong. Saddam Hussein wasn't going to invade. He invaded. The first time around, we thought he didn't have weapons of mass destruction. Turns out he had a lot. Second time around, just the opposite. Be very careful about your assumptions. Second of all, particularly in this case of the Second War, you ought to know a lot about the country you're going to invade before you invade it. That's a lesson of Vietnam. It's a lesson of the Second Iraq War. There's no substitute for local knowledge. Global grand abstractions tend to get you in trouble, whether it was anti-communism or transformation and democracy. You would better know an awful lot about the political culture and history of this place that you're taking on.
Are you any happier about the current situation? President Obama has announced plans for a major troop buildup in Afghanistan and has expressed desire to wind down operations in Iraq. We had Rory Stewart here recently. He's an expert on both countries, and he said that it was easier. The surge was predictably going to be a lot easier in Iraq than a similar surge would be in Afghanistan. So are we just going to make the same kinds of mistakes in Afghanistan now?
Two things. One is I do not believe the United States will be able to meet the timetables laid out by the president to get out of Iraq. I don't believe we will be able to or should meet them. I believe the danger would be that Iraq would unravel in our wake if we were to leave. So my prediction is all of those timetables will be adjusted, and we will actually be staying in Iraq at some level for some time to come. In the case of Afghanistan, I'm familiar with Rory Stewart's critique. He may be right. This is a war of choice. Afghanistan has become a war of choice for Barack Obama. Doesn't mean it's wrong, but it is somewhat risky. And you know, so long as Pakistan in particular is a sanctuary, it's not clear to me that this war of choice will pay off.
Just one more thing, because we're pretty much out of time. But earlier this month, you wrote an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal about the release of the torture memos. Can you explain your position?
Well, if you recall, the principal debate at the time was whether the people who wrote those memos, the lawyers in the Justice Department, ought to be prosecuted. And I said no, that they were making what I thought was akin to the case that accountants make for tax avoidance rather than tax evasion. They were making a narrow legal case that harsh interrogation techniques were not technically torture. And even if you disagreed, they don't make the policy. That's why you have interagency meetings and presidents and cabinet officials meet and they decide what our policy is going to be. You're always going to have advocates for any particular policy. So the fact that they were advocating didn't bother me. Again, I thought the problem with the 43rd president was the decision-making machinery he set up was simply not sufficiently rigorous.
But didn't the Nuremberg trials establish that I was just following orders isn't a good enough case?
But they weren't just following orders.
John Yoo was some of the things he came up with.
But he believed those things. He wasn't doing it because he was following orders. He did it because he believed that this was what was in the interest of the United States. And I would simply remind people that after 9/11, if people were going to err, they were going to err on the side of giving U.S. officials more rather than less latitude to protect this country.
So by extension, are you suggesting that we should be prosecuting George Bush, who you said his mind was made up way in advance, Dick Cheney, some of the other people who actually established policy?
Not at all. I don't believe that these are matters of criminality. I think these are matters of political judgment, and that's why we have elections in this country, and that's why we have a free press, and that's why we have shows like this. You debate the issues. I don't believe that the courtroom is a place where political issues should be fought out.
Richard Haass is president of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was a principal advisor to Secretary of State Colin Powell from 2001-2003, special assistant to President George H.W. Bush, and senior director on the staff of the National Security Council from 1989 to 1993. His book, War of Necessity, War of Choice, A Memoir of Two Iraq Wars, is published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Richard Haass will be in conversation with Katie Couric tonight at 8 at the 92nd Street Y. I hope she treats you better than she treated Sarah Palin. For more information, visit our show page at WNYC.org. Up next, Gerald Martin discusses the 17-year process of writing the first comprehensive biography of the great Colombian novelist Gabriel Garcia Marquez. I want to alert you to our new listener contest. Fashion designer Isaac Mizrahi challenges you to design a T-shirt. Be creative as you can. Visit our show page at WNYC.org for more information and for some inspiration. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.